Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, we hear about the proposed ban on lead shot in Ireland, used to kill wetland birds. Enin Ilana dives into the world of freshwater pearl mussels. And we get the lowdown on five foul-mounted parrots at a wildlife park and wonder, just why do parrots sing? Extraordinary. Imagine a singing parrot. In fact, better than Beyonce, if you ask me. In studio with me today, we've Niall Hatch of Birdwatch on. And Niall, how are you today? All good?
Not too bad, Derek.
Looking forward to that story on the parrot later on, I'm sure
I
you are.
I love parrots, I do.
I bet you do. And still cocooning at his home in Malahide in North County Dublin is Dr. Richard Collins. Richard.
Hello, Derek. Yes, that parrot calling reminds me of an American president. American presidents are in the news right now. Andrew Jackson, 1840s, a widower, had a pet parrot. Mm-hmm. And when Andrew died, there was a huge funeral, and the parrot was present. But of course, the parrot started mouthing the most appalling obscenities. He was described by the minister conducting the service as a wicked parrot.
I'm sure he was.
Yes, and he lived in infamy, the phrase that Roosevelt used after Pearl Harbor. I read somewhere that that phrase actually was first used about Paul Andrew Jackson's parrot. However, I'm leading you off on a tangent.
But the ability for a parrot to sing, Richard. Is that not extraordinary? Whatever about effing and blinding?
Yes, it's an extraordinary sound. It's not a songbird, you must understand. It's not like the hill mynah, which is wonderful. I remember one they used to have in the zoo years ago. But yes. Now, remember, there's two levels at which this takes place. One is a kind of trigger. Calls on things are triggers. So a parrot loves to vocalise if he gets a response from his peers. So what he's doing is trying to trigger the response in the hearer. Whether the hearer has a parrot or whether it's his adopted tribe, which is us, then he just wants to trigger. So he'll dish up more and more complicated sounds to get the lovely reaction he wants, you know. Do you think, Niall, that they are blathering parrot fashion, as we say, or whether there is denotation or whatever, are they describing in any sense? I mean, Alex the parrot, the famous one, is Pepperberg's famous bird, and we had her on the program some years ago. She seemed to think that the parrot was modeling the world and was articulating things in his head, you know. That would be a much higher level. It wouldn't be just triggering anymore, you know. It would be a much higher cognitive ability than we credit parrots for. What do you think?
Certainly, without doubt, they're very intelligent birds, and we know that they're highly social, and intelligence and sociability tend to go together. Intelligence tends to evolve in species that like to live in big flocks together or big groups and have to interact with each other and read each other's emotions. Of course, trying to draw parallels between the human brain and the parrot brain is very difficult because, to some extent, it's like us trying to understand an alien. They certainly don't think the same way we do. Their values aren't the same as human values. Their perception of the world would be very different. I do think they like to get a response from people, and they can certainly learn from stimuli how what sort of response might be expected from them, or will get some sort of a reward. But certainly in the case of Alex, the famous parrot that you mentioned, it did seem indeed that that particular bird was capable of formulating thoughts and using the appropriate expressions, even answering some very simple rudimentary questions. I know that some work has been done with budgerigars in Russia as well, where experiments have been done where people have claimed to be able to have admittedly very basic conversations, but two-way conversations with these small parrots. So there's definitely something going on there. But again, we really don't understand each other as species. It's very hard for a parrot to read us and for us to read a parrot and to pick up each other's cues, I think.
The most extreme and controversial ability that Alex, the sage in the cage, as he was called, he seemed to have a concept of an absence. Now, a philosopher in UCD used to say that the greatest invention of all time by us was the invention of the number zero, the concept of nothingness and a symbol for it. Now, the Greeks didn't manage that. The Romans didn't manage that. It was invented by an Indian. And it was imported by no less a man than Fibonacci into Italy in around the end of the 11th century. But anyway, Alex had a word for nothing. If he was shown various objects, he would have words for them. But when he was shown nothing, he had a word for that. So a very controversial conclusion was that he had mastered the notion of nothingness, and that would be a very sophisticated notion for something like a parrot to adapt.
I know that certainly other birds, you know, that are good mimics of birds, like crows. Like parrots in the wild have never been heard to imitate human voice or human sounds, but crows certainly have. I remember hearing a case, I think it was a long time ago, in an issue of British Birds, but somewhere in Britain there was a jay, which is a very colourful member of the crow family, which had learned to mimic calls and the whistles that a shepherd was giving to his sheepdog. And when the shepherd was away, this jay seemed to delight in giving commands to the sheepdog, which thought it was its master telling it what to do, and was rounding up the sheep and running them randomly all over the field. And it certainly seemed that the jay was getting a kick out of this. I think it ended badly for the jay. I think, unfortunately, that the farmer ended up shooting it because of all the havoc it was causing. So there's a sad end to that story. But it is interesting to see that some birds do realise that by mimicking human sounds, they can elicit a response from humans and from other creatures.
Yeah, of course, you mentioned crows and the famous Caledonian crow experiments in Oxford, where metatool use has been recorded in birds and in crows. It's one thing to use a tool, but it's a further sophistication to actually construct a tool to use. And some birds peel off a little branch to make it small, to poke it into a hole to get at insects. Well, now, the Caledonian crows were able to assemble bits together to make a long rake in order to pull a piece of meat or something into their cages. Now, that shows modelling. That shows working out scenarios in your head, running possible things and predicting what the likely outcome is. That means you have a mind, you have an internal life, you are conscious and aware. You're like us.
Anyway, we'll be talking about these foul-mouthed parrots in Lincolnshire a little bit later on in the programme, and we'll try to answer some of those questions that Richard has brought up there. But Niall, you want to mention a lead shot ban in Ireland. Explain the background to this story.
Yes, it's a proposed ban at this stage, but it looks like it will be coming in. So earlier this month, the European Chemicals Agency, at the suggestion of the European Commission, had a proposal that lead shot be banned for shotgun hunting of water birds at wetland sites. And various European member states voted in favour of this, including Ireland. And so now the next step is that this goes before the European Parliament before it becomes law. But it's looking very like it will. Now, the rationale behind this is it's a very important one. Lead has been banned in many, for pretty much all human uses. You think of paint and pipes and so forth, because of its extreme toxicity. There's no safe level of lead. It's an incredibly toxic material. But it has continued to be used in shotgun pellets at wetland sites particularly. What happens is that obviously the bird that's shot itself is killed or injured, and that's part and parcel of hunting. But the problem is the pellets that miss end up sinking down to the bottom of these lakes and these marshes and streams, and getting mixed in with the grit there. And what happens is that birds, to digest food, they have to ingest grit, which they hold in their gizzards.
Hence the reason you see a lot of crows on the side of the road just getting some grit to help their digestion.
That's right, they have no teeth, so they need to keep these stones in their body to grind up their food. And of course, when they take the grit in the wetlands, they're taking in the lead as well. Then this grinding action releases it into their bodies, and it's incredibly toxic. So it kills many of these birds, makes them very, very sick as well for a long period of time. It also affects birds of prey and other creatures that feed on them. And then, of course, it also affects humans as well. So maybe here in the food chain in Ireland, there aren't too many people eating wetland birds, but these birds migrate.
So secondary poisoning.
A lot of people in Mediterranean regions, in the Middle East, in parts of Africa, they are feeding on these birds, and lead toxicity is becoming a problem. I know, Richard, that obviously you've done a lot of work with swans, and this was a big problem for swans, particularly over the years, wasn't it?
Yes, in fact, it was one of the striking things that emerged fairly quickly. For instance, of the mute swans that I studied, 46% had bred by the time they were five. Now, if you looked at the British swans, they were breeding at 2, 3, and 4. They were much ahead of ours. Now, why? Well, I think the answer was the use of lead shot by coarse anglers in Britain. What happens in Britain, or did then, this is a decade or two ago now, was that people used lead shot to catch roach and rudd and perch and things of this kind widely in British ponds and lakes and canals and things. They didn't do much of that here. People here didn't do much coarse fishing. The result was that the swans in England were picking up the lead, and they were dying of lead poisoning. And that made lots of vacancies on territories there for swans. The old pair were dying off due to lead poisoning, and there was much faster recruitment to the breeding population. The young birds were moving in and starting to breed in place of the old. Now, that wasn't happening at all to the same extent here. So, therefore, our ones delayed breeding for much longer and moved around the country much more. They were flying the length and breadth of Ireland. Some went to Wales and England. One went to Scotland. Now, lead was crucial to what was happening, I firmly believe.
And when a swan is affected by lead, what sort of symptoms do you see?
Well, I've seen this many times. What happens is that it swallows the lead for the gizzard. It goes down to the proventriculus, which is the opening of the stomach, if you like. Now, the musculature of the proventriculus gets paralysed with the poison in the lead. So the movement of food into the gut fails, and the food builds up in the neck, in the esophagus, all the way up, and the bird gets very heavy, full of food, because it's not passing the food into the stomach. And eventually it's dying of starvation, full of food down to the gizzard, until eventually the head falls backwards because he can't even keep it up any longer. It is a cruel death, but that is what used to happen.
So what's going to happen now?
Well, so the proposal still has to go to the European Parliament. We don't know what the time frame for that is, presumably within the next few months. They'll vote on that then. It's important to note that there is overwhelming support for this ban from most European member states. In fact, Ireland is one of the few that still at the moment permits the use of lead shot at wetlands. Some conservationists would like to see go further than that and have it in the wider countryside, make lead shot completely illegal. But at the moment, the proposal is just for wetlands, because that has the most effect on birds and other wildlife, because they're more likely to ingest those lead pellets in the substrate in the lakes and the rivers. So that will go before then. If it becomes law, then what happens is then each European Union member state will then have to pass national legislation outlawing the use of lead shotgun pellets. There will be a phase out period. I don't think it'll be an overnight ban. I think there will be a period of time where people can phase out the use of this and switch to other alternatives like a stainless steel shot, which is a non-toxic alternative.
So you have no issue, or do you, with the deliberate shooting of wetland birds? It's the secondary poisoning of other species that have not been directly targeted.
That's exactly it. It's the persistent effects within the environment. Well-regulated hunting can be part and parcel of nature conservation in some cases. It's not it's not something like myself I'm interested in or would like to be involved with. But the fact is that well-regulated hunting can happen. Hunters can be a real force for conservation. But lead shot itself, the persistent effects of the environment that it causes, that's the issue here.
Okay, now we were talking about swans, and if you're a regular listener to the programme, right throughout the COVID crisis, we have been following a family of swans. When I say a family, the male, the father is missing, but there is a female mute swan in Blessington Basin. Originally, she had 6 cygnets, and I was there for the very first swim of those 6 cygnets, and we've been following them ever since. But sad news has reached us. One of the cygnets is dead. Terry Flanagan went to Blessington Street Basin and picks up the story from there.
Well, here I am again in Blessington Street Basin, or the Secret Garden as it's known. And if you've never been here, it's a place that you really should come to. It's a tiny little park. It's only about 500 metres from the top of O'Connell Street, hidden away in behind Berkeley Road Church and the Mater Hospital. And once you come into it, it's just a little oasis, a little garden, a walled garden with this beautiful lake or pond in the middle of it. The last time I was here, it was late June, and we had good news because we were following the family of swans that are here. Now, unfortunately, there was only a mammy swan. There is no daddy swan, but she had 6 cygnets, beautiful little cygnets that were progressing along nicely. And they've been going along like that for the last couple of months. But unfortunately, we've got bad news today. John Seary, you're a local. You come to this garden quite a lot. Tell us a little bit about it.
Hi, Terry. You're very welcome to Blessing Street Basin. It's a wonderful little resource in the city centre. Not just a mix of history, but also a lot of wildlife in the park. I've seen squirrels, I've seen foxes. And apart from the mentioned swans there's loads of ducks, loads of different types of birds that hang around the area. And also it's a great place during the last 6 months to have been visiting to escape the lockdown. And it's been fantastic to have that resource. But just what struck me over the last few months was the actual level of wildlife that seemed to be just continuing to grow. And not just in terms of types or different types of wildlife, but also, as you mentioned there, the swans themselves and the fact that we've seen the progression of a swan and her brood. And it was wonderful to see earlier this year around March, April, to see six cygnets emerge during spring and to see them grow and prosper and do very well. And then, unfortunately, more recently, I've just noticed that there's only five left. And curiously, I was really worried as to what happened there because they were doing very, very well. They were almost, I think, at this stage, I don't know whether it's true or not, they were almost reaching adulthood. And it was a bit of a shock to see the sixth one missing. And it did pose a few questions to myself as to what could have happened, this swan.
Before we go on to talk about the little baby swan that's missing, there was no daddy swan at all. The mammy, the female, she raised this family on her own.
It seems to be the case, Terry. Yeah, I mean, I noticed that normally anywhere I've walked around Dublin where I've seen, a nest, there's usually the mammy and daddy hanging around. But in this case, since March, it's just been the mammy, and the actual six cygnets as well have been very obedient. They were always following her. The mother was protecting them very actively. If you saw even a sense of maybe more seagulls hanging around, you would see the actual mother swan intervene and drive them out of the area. So, quite a protective mother.
Well, we were here, as I said, in June. It was late June, and they were doing tremendously well. But what's happened?
Well, unfortunately, as I mentioned, the sixth one seems to have gone missing. And last week I made an inquiry from the local park attendants here as to what happened. And in a good way, but also in a very tragic way, he confirmed that the sixth cygnet was actually discovered on the little island within the basin there. And it seems to have just died of natural causes. And in many ways, while that is tragic, at least the swan or the cygnet didn't meet a more sinister end. So, unfortunate as it is, at the same time, it is reassuring that the baby was found without what it seems to be any injury whatsoever.
Or without any kind of human interference.
Yes, yeah. That's, while it's probably not that common, it'd be even more sad to think that the cygnet met a more gruesome end, yeah.
Now, I know you have a number of questions for Derek and the team.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that really struck me about this. Firstly, when you see, I suppose one of their offspring, disappear like that, would the mother or the father of the swan, would they have noticed that? And would they have been searching for their baby actively? Because in this case, to all I know, the mother was still going around with her five remaining cygnets like no tomorrow, everything was okay. Maybe that's just my take on it. Another question I'd have is the remaining cygnets seem quite mature. They're, I'd say, at least three quarters of the size of the mother. And I'm just surprised that the mother hasn't tried to get rid of them, get them out of the house. But so, just a question as to when should we expect the remaining cygnets now to be told to go away and go fly away, I suppose,
Well, to synopsize on those, the first question really is the others, do they notice that something is wrong? Do they miss them? And the second question then was, when is the right time for these young swans to move off onto their own territories? Another question I might have as well is, I just wonder about the emotions of the swans. Do they actually realise that they have lost a brother or a sister? Or that the mammy, does she realise she's lost a young one? And what feelings do they have?
Thank you very much indeed, Terry, and to John Seary, who's a local in the area in Dublin 7. So, Richard, so many questions. Well, we start with the emotional one. Do swans experience emotions?
Oh dear, that's a very tricky question indeed. You have to ask yourself what function emotions would play ecologically. In other words, you evolve what you need to help you survive and reproduce. And we are very complex animals, very complex socially, so we have a complex emotional life which drives us in various directions, love and hate and everything else. Now, it's just something like a swan, that would not necessarily be the case at all. It is triggered by stimuli from the outside. It probably doesn't have any internal life, any mental life, do you know what I mean? Mm. Always remember what the elephant said when he met the naked man in the forest. He said, "How do you feed yourself with that thing?" Well, now, we are something like that. When we meet a swan, we think that since we are conscious and have emotions and minds and conscious of the past and the present and the flow of time and all that, then we assume that other creatures are like us in that regard. Like the elephant and the naked man, we conclude that they have a conscious mental world of their own. And there is no basis for us saying that. In fact, well, it might be true still, we don't know.
Do they have emotions or not?
Well, of course, if you're under anaesthetic,
yeah. Well, I think
if you're not conscious, if you have no mental life, you cannot experience emotions, feelings, you see. So if, in fact, something as complex as the emotions, the mind did not evolve in something like swan to any great extent as in us, then it won't feel anything. But that is an opinion. Now, this is a controversial subject.
Okay.
But anyway,
what about the question as to whether or not the siblings and the female actually missed the missing swan?
Well, that's interesting, because what happens with things like cygnets, the brown plumage and the calls cygnets make are triggers. They trigger a behaviour, rather like somebody screaming, you know, or a baby crying. When you hear a baby cry, you don't start thinking, oh, that must be a baby, what'll I do stuff. You go immediately to the baby. Or if somebody shouts fire, you don't start trying to figure out what's going on. You head for the exit. Well, now, so things like the brown of a cygnet, the call of a cygnet, the posture of a cygnet will trigger a response in a mother. Now, if the cygnet gets separated from its parents, it will start squeaking, and that acts as a sign stimulus to bring the mother to search for it. But if it doesn't do that, and if it's lying a brown mass on the ground, then the response will not occur, in my opinion.
When will they fledge?
Oh, well, now that's an interesting...
Actually, fledge isn't the term here, is it? At what point does the female, the adult female, decide these have got to be run out of town? You don't say fledge for swans, do you? What is the term you use?
Well, you use a fledge. Fledge means normally when a bird is able to fly, leaves the nest and can fly. Mm. Now, in the case of the cygnets there, they will hang on there through the winter and probably on into the spring. Now, as that happens, they will begin to have white plumage. The plumage will get whiter. They're brown and grey at the moment. Now, normally the daddy would be present. Now, the daddy gets very upset when there's a brown bird other than his lawful wedded wife on the territory, and he can attack such a bird. That's what he instinctively does. And, of course, as the summer, the winter wears on and into spring, he's going to have, in this case, five whitish birds on his territory, and that, if he were there, but he's not. And that would normally trigger aggression, and he would force them off. He has to do that because the female has to start forming eggs again for next season, and she's going to need the resources of the place to do that. She's going to have to fatten up.
She's there. So when are they going to leave?
There will be some of that in her as well.
Tim, so what do you think is likely to happen? When are they likely to go?
I think they're likely to last into March, April, and then... what is likely to happen is that another cod will move
March, April,
in.
Next year.
Yeah. And then
a whole year?
Wow. Yes, they will. In that case, normally they would tend to be gone from January, February if the male was there, but I think it would be delayed. But I've seen them linger on to March in places, even with an aggressive daddy around, but that's a very small place.
So, Richard, it's not really that unexpected that one out of six cygnets so far would have perished. This is actually usually par for the course.
I'm surprised that more of them didn't perish, because it's not a very good territory. There's not the world of natural food there. So I'm surprised in a way that more of them haven't gone to the wall.
Yeah, I mean, Blessington Street Basin, it's a lovely amenity within the city, and it's a great place to spend time. But it is a strange habitat for swans and other water birds, because it's extremely deep. It was originally built, I think, as a reservoir for water for the Jameson Distillery when it was in Dublin there. And that's the way they got the water from for the whiskey. But so it was built to be very, very deep, which means that for birds, even long-necked birds like swans, they can't really reach down to the bottom to get food. So I think that a lot of them there really subsist on food that humans throw to them. I know that the authorities there have put up signs asking people please not to feed bread to them and to use leafy vegetables and things like that instead, or to maybe refrain from feeding them altogether. But I do fear that the swans there must have a really quite a high junk food diet, and that can't be great for the development of the cygnets.
Indeed not. It's a lovely park. It was originally the reservoir supplying water to North Dublin City, and then it was taken over by Jemison's. And it's mentioned in Ulysses by James Joyce, believe it or not. It's immortal.
Yeah, very good.
All right, thank you very much indeed, Richard, and thanks to John and thanks to Terry for giving us that update. And we'll watch this space. And you always say, you know, the longer you live when you're a bird or any kind of wild animal. If you get past the first week, you stand a good chance of making it in the second, and so on and so forth. So with a bit of luck, these swans will make it. How long lived our mute swans? Just to remind everybody, Richard.
Well, now, the oldest I had was at least 24, because I ringed him as an adult. Now, there were two, a colleague of mine working in Britain on the Severn, he had a couple that were 25 and 26. And then, a few years ago, Pelle Andersen Harald in Denmark turned up one 40 years of age. So, there are all kinds of possibilities.
And they're not like dogs, is it a year for a year?
In what sense?
Yeah, well, 1 year in our life is the equivalent of 1 year in a swan's life.
Oh, well, it would be that
sort of
thing.
What is it for dogs? It's something like 6 years, isn't it? Isn't that what they say?
Seven, I think they say. But there's some dispute over that. They think the puppies age faster than humans would.
Yeah, their heartbeat's about three times our sort of thing. So if you use that as a factor of three sort of stuff. If we live 20 years, 60 would be the normal thing for a swan. And 140, well, by 320, that fits fairly well.
Goodbye, Richard. Bye.
Goodbye.
Anyway, there goes Richard. Now, the freshwater pearl mussel is capable of surviving for up to 140 years, making it Ireland's longest living animal. Did you know that, Niall Hatch?
I actually did, but I still find it an amazing statistic. Yeah, they're amazing, amazing creatures.
How did you know that?
I like animals.
You're like Richard. But 90% of all freshwater pearl mussels died out across Europe during the 20th century. And they're now one of the 365 most endangered species in the world, on the verge of extinction. In Ireland, 19 special areas of conservation have been designated in an effort to conserve the pearl mussel in its native habitats. And a new joint initiative between the Marine Institute and the National Parks and Wildlife Service is aiming to revitalise our mussel populations. They intend to do this through a pilot captive breeding programme based at the Marine Institute's Newport Research Facility in County Mayo. Well, as you can hear, Aine Ní Leabhar is not with us today, but she was in during the week. And when she was here, she spoke with Dr. Elvira Di Aito, a zoologist at the Marine Institute, about the pearl mussel.
I first came across freshwater pearl mussels in the 1980s, I remember. Down in Waterford, they wanted to build a landfill site, one of those old dumps that they were called in those days. And lo and behold, didn't they discover freshwater mussels in the river, and they were able to get rid of having the landfill site in that particular part of Waterford. So even then, they were rare. Even then, they needed absolutely clean, pristine water. So it's been around for a long time in Ireland, very scarce mussels, but they're here now. And what you're doing in Borrowshrule is a captive breeding programme, and this is the first one of its kind in Ireland. Tell us about it, Elvira.
Thanks, Aine. So I think there has been previous attempts to run captive breeding programmes, but this is the first time that we're doing it in Borrowshrule. And I would say from the outset, you know, we'd prefer not to be doing this. We would prefer if it hadn't come to this, but we are where we are. And until we sort out some of the issues issues like you raised in the 1980s to do with land use changes and things like that, we now are in the situation where we do have to conserve the very last remaining reproducing mussels in Ireland. So here in Bereshiúil, we're really lucky. We've had actually a salmon hatchery on site since the 1950s, actually. So we have 70 years of experience of running a salmon hatchery. And our colleagues in National Parks and Wildlife approached us and said maybe we could try this captive breeding programme with pearl mussels here. So we've just started last month in June, actually, and we're hopeful that we'll be able to at least produce some of the next generation of freshwater mussels.
Because the thing about the freshwater mussel is its life cycle is very peculiar, if you like, because it actually needs the salmon in order to carry on its life cycle. I mean, you can have these adult mussels living up to 140 years, but the actual important bit is the reproductive section. So the reproduction bit needs the attention of salmon. Can you spell out in detail what's going on there and why the salmon play such an important role?
The mussels, they're a fascinating animal. Like you say, they really, really long lived. Even in, you know, northern areas, they might live to 200 years old. But in Ireland, it's about 100, 120 years old. And they reproduce for most of those years. They become mature to reproduce after between 7 and 15 years old. And then the females, the large female mussels and the male mussels, they will produce very, very small little larvae called glaucidia. And those glaucidia need to attach onto a salmon within a couple of days. So they come out of the mussels, they're expelled from the mussels, and they need to attach onto the gills of either a salmon or a trout within a couple of days. So the salmon suck them in when they're through their water, through their mouth, and then as the water is passing out through their gills, these little tiny larvae, the glaucidia, they attach onto the gills. And that's where they live. So they live on the gills of those fish for about 10 months. So we would have expected the larvae to have been produced around July, and then they will hopefully be on the gills of the salmon for the next 10 months, and then early next year they will drop off the gills and into, well, ideally into the bottom of a riverbed, into a lovely pristine gravel bed. But in the hatchery, they will drop onto the bottom of the tank where we have the fish at the moment, and we'll collect them and hopefully move on to the next step. So yeah, the really crucial part of the life stage, the reproduction, once the mussels have reproduced, they produce millions and millions of larvae. They have to find a fish to attach onto, and then when they drop off, that's the really crucial time, because they need to have a habitat to drop into where they can live for 5 years, a really clean, fine sediment with lots of oxygen, fast flowing water, and that's where they'll be for 5 years until they grow big enough to kind of poke their heads up through into the water, and then they'll be set there for about 100 years. So it's really complex, and there's a lot of challenges, and so we're on the first step of this captive breeding program at the moment, hoping that they attach onto our fish in the pond in the hatchery, and we'll see what happens early next year, hopefully.
What stage are the salmon at? I mean, you don't want to be attached to a salmon, which then proceeds down the river and goes off to sea. So at what stage in the life cycle of the salmon do these things get attached to their gills?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the young salmon, so they're the what we would call par, about 1 year old salmon. Obviously, in our hatchery, they're a little bit more fast growing, but in the wild, there would be the small fish, about, you know, 12, 13, 14 centimetres, either salmon or trout. And then they will have dropped off the fish before the fish gets to the stage where it's going to be a migratory fish. So before it gets to the stage of leaving the river. So it's just that pretty tight time frame that they're all operating under.
And they have to get left behind at the upper reaches of the rivers where these small fish are. Now, the rivers have to be alkaline rivers, do they? Because after all, the mussels have shells made out of calcium, so you won't get them, or will you, in acid streams.
Not necessarily. I mean, a lot of the pearl mussel population, certainly on the west coast of Ireland, would be in fairly acidic kind of areas, naturally acidic areas. And one of the reasons they're so long lived and so old is because they just grow really, really slowly and take whatever calcium they can get in the rivers. So no, they do. I mean, we know they're in, for example, the catchment where our hatchery is, the Marine Institute hatchery is, the Bershiel catchment, which is an acidic catchment. Unfortunately, we don't have a viable pearl mussel population anymore, but they would have been here years ago. And our neighbouring catchment, the Newport River, then also has pearl mussel. So it doesn't necessarily have to be an alkaline river. Probably they grow faster, though, if it is an alkaline river, and they're, you know, they might grow to a bigger size quicker. But yeah, they can, like, I think probably their natural range in Ireland would have been all over the country.
So then they really are an indicator species of really good habitat, because you have to have clean, pristine water with lots of oxygen. You have to have healthy 1-year-old small fish, and you have to have the reproducing pearl mussel mussels there already. So they're absolutely first class honours, if you like. And as I suppose the quality of our water declines in Ireland, these are the very first to go. So what is their distribution now? How abundant are they any longer?
Unfortunately, since, you know, the time of World War II, there's been a 90% decline in freshwater mussels across Europe. And Ireland, I mean, Ireland has, you know, some of the remaining populations, about half of the European freshwater mussels are in Ireland. But nevertheless, they're really, really restricted distribution in comparison to what they were. So we have 19 special area of conservations in Ireland where they have a population of pearl mussels. None of those populations are currently viable, so none of them are producing anything like the quantities of young or small mussels that we would like to see. So it's really, really restricted, and like you say, it's all down to the freshwater quality and the amount of sediment and nutrients that are coming off the catchments, the disturbance, flow regulation, the channelization of rivers. So all that dredging for flood relief and everything hasn't done the pearl mussels any good. And so, yeah, they are like the ultimate indicator species. If you've lost your pearl mussel, you know there is something quite wrong going on in the river. And unfortunately, if you've lost your freshwater mussel, then, you know, that's an obvious thing that if you lost. What's probably even as concerning is all the other things that are probably going with the freshwater mussel. So, you know, historically, if we think about when they were all over the country and there was hundreds of thousands of mussels in all the nice, pristine, free-flowing rivers, they were probably doing a really, really good ecosystem service. So they were filtering a huge amount of the water coming through the rivers. They were filtering out fine sediments. They were growing, and they were producing a habitat that all the fish would have really benefited from. All the little small insects would have been benefited from. They introduced oxygen into the sediments of the river. So they were one of these animals that, you know, produced a really good habitat for everything else. And we've probably forgotten that because there's so few of them left. We don't realise maybe the service that they did provide historically. And I suppose this captive breeding programme just gives us the potential to envisage that we could be able to do that in the future. So if we sort out a lot of the catchment issues, we can then reintroduce some of these, the larvae that we will produce in Furness, into suitable habitats, hopefully, in the years to come, and bring some of those populations back to a kind of normally functioning population. So that's what we're aiming for.
So they really were, in fact, a keystone species because they affected the habitat in which they lived. Did anything eat them?
I suspect when they're very small, I suspect when they're very small and buried in the sediment, certain little things might be able to eat it, like even little crayfish and things like that, maybe even little tiny fish. But once they get a little bit bigger, you know, they're pretty well armoured. Those bivalve mollusks are pretty well armoured. I guess things like otter and some of those other animals might be able to scoop them out, you know, the way you see other things scooping out shellfish. But they're pretty well armoured and pretty well protected. So
So yeah, so it's really their actual enemy is the quality of the water, and the enemy is really at the stage where the reproduction is happening. Because once, I mean, you can have pearl water mussels there for 100 years, and if the quality of the water has deteriorated, the adults are okay, but they're never going to reproduce again. So your research is going to provide a way of getting farming, if you like, captive breeding, so that we can put them back in the rivers if we get them cleaned up.
Yeah, that's right. And like I said at the start, this is a last resort. We would far prefer not to be doing this. But there are some really, really great projects going on. So we had the Kerry Life Project, which ran from 2014 to 2018. And now we have the Pearl Mussel EIP. So it's a really big locally led farming project, running in about 8 catchments around the country, and they are doing the kind of really fundamental work, which is managing the catchment, stabilising the banks of the rivers, making sure that there isn't a lot of nutrients going into the river, making sure there's not sediment going into the river. And once we hopefully see those measures starting to reap rewards in terms of the quality of the river, then we can think about reintroducing these captive bred mussels into the river. But we can only do that if there's habitat to put them back into. And unfortunately, we just came to the point where we realised that the time that it takes to put those river rehabilitation measures into action, by the time they start to reap rewards, the mussels may well be gone. So that's why we said, well, we better get a move on and try and have some kind of jump on having a captive bred population to reintroduce in those areas where we can. So that's where we are right now in Furness. We currently have one tank of fish with about 300 salmon in it. And we took 30 adults from the Newport River, which is our neighbouring catchment. And we have them in with the salmon, and we're just waiting to see have they successfully reproduced, and then we'll see where we are next year.
It's all about habitat management, isn't it? Listen, it's great to talk to you, Elvira. Thank you very much for letting us know all that's going on in Barrishool.
Thanks, Aina.
And more details can be found on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Back to our famous singing parrot now, Chico. That's Chico, who's resident at Lincolnshire Wildlife Park. And here's a headline you won't hear every day. 5 foul-mouthed parrots have been moved away from the public after repeatedly telling Wildlife Park visitors to F off. It is said that the African grey parrots, a species noted for their advanced cognitive abilities and ability to talk, egged each other on for laughs, insulting visitors. The boss of Lincolnshire Wildlife Park is Steve Nichols. He says the parrots turned their aviary into a boozy working men's club at closing time. Steve joins us now from the parrots' new enclosure at Lincolnshire Wildlife Park. Steve, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
So tell us all about these parrots.
Well, basically, it's very unusual. I mean, we obviously take in parrots, and African greys are renowned for their talking abilities. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on which side you look at it, most people do teach their parrots to say one or two rude, ominous words that you try to keep out of the way when they start repeating it. And then what we usually do is when they say something like that, we then generally laugh. And that means that they've triggered a reaction from us. So they then just log that in that little storage, and if they need to, and they feel a little bored every now and then, they need to get our attention, they'll come out with these nice words. You then jump up, start laughing or do whatever, and they've achieved it. So on the odd occasion, we get those birds coming in. Usually what happens is because it's such a big move to them, and there's over 1,500 parrots here, so it becomes quite an adventure for them. So they don't stop talking, but they're more interested in what's going off around them. But then just by coincidence, we had 5 arrive from 5 different places, from the south of England to the north of England. And all their owners mentioned when they dropped them off, I do apologise, but they do actually say one or two right words. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's OK. There's not much I haven't heard when it comes to parrots. And which is, unfortunately, it's true. I mean, it's a good job I don't have a complex, because some of the things that they say as you're walking past, it's not very complimentary.
There's no filter.
Oh, there's definitely no filter. Don't worry about that. And so what we have to do is, we have to quarantine these animals, so they have to go into a controlled area so we can do a disease test and weigh them and microchip and make sure they're okay generally, and then assess them for a few days before we start moving them to slowly getting out into the main flock. What they usually do, most parrots, is if they want attention, they will start shouting, making not very nice noises or doing what they do most. But obviously, if they get a reaction, and usually from a person, they've achieved what they want. But these five birds literally were sat at the side of each other. And within a couple of days, one of our assistants, she actually mentioned, said, have you heard how bad those parrots swear? And I said, yeah, but I've heard parrots swear, so don't worry, it's not that bad. But I then walked in literally within 15 minutes of walking in, one of them told me to F off. And I thought that, but then when it did that, obviously I would naturally laugh. But before I laughed, one of the other parrots laughed because they're used to hearing that. So
they're effing and laughing at the same time.
So that's it. And then as soon as he did it, another one. And I mean, some of the words are just not, literally, not, no matter what they are, they're not very good for viewers or listeners, because then they go into real obscenities and the B word comes out and the T word comes out. And between them, then at that point, what we always do, I mean, what we're trying to do is do some secret recording, because anything that you turn up with, they literally look and think, aye, aye, he's trying to do the same as what all our owners have done and he's trying to record us. And they just go shtum. They just stop talking. So we got used to that and said, well, they've been through quarantine. They're fine. We, once they get outside, they'll be all right. And literally within 2 days of being outside, again, one of the keepers went to check them out, and we continue to the health checks for the next 23 days. And we literally was out there sorting, and she came out and said, Steve, one of them's telling me to F off again. And one of the public heard her. And I said, well, that's all right, don't worry. Now, the public haven't complained. Nobody's actually put in a complaint. But what we did do is we...
What would you do when, if they did?
I don't know. I don't know if you like the TripAdvisor. I'm not very good on TripAdvisor if it comes through saying all the actual animals are actually abusing you as you walk through. I said, well, it should be okay, don't worry. They'll soon calm down. But within 2 or 3 days, we realised that We have parrots that sing, and when they sing for attention, that gets people gathering round. Well, swearing parrots do exactly the same. However, the problem we've got is when you've got swearing parrots and adults laughing and joking, which sounds brilliant, then you've got the youngsters underneath that are walking off saying, God, did you hear that parrot? It's just tell somebody to... And they'd say it as well. And then the adults would start shouting at the kids.
I know, and like, but oh. I mean, we have to have a little bit of light relief in these tragic times, do we not?
For us, it's brilliant. I mean, basically, it's literally, it's been a horrendous 18 months for our charity. And we've had this singing parrot that's gone viral around the world. And now we've got the most blue parrots that you can have on the planet. And when they say blue planet, I don't think David Attenborough meant this blue planet. But what we have now is these birds that literally, they just swear. Like other birds say hello, they tell you to F off. And we've got used to it, so it's just... Ultimately, they will be out. I mean, they're not very far from the general public now. They're very close to where they are, but there's about 240, 250 African greys behind them. So they actually, and that's what the general public can see.
Why have you got so many parrots?
Unfortunately, people realise at a certain point in their life that, and it's usually, we think it's, I've done this for 30 years, so I think basically people have a subconscious decision made for them. And what they say is the very first day that they say, I wonder if Polly or Billy or Tommy is happy, they know he's not. So they try ultimately for probably maybe a year, 2 years to do everything they possibly can to make the bird happy, not realizing that these monogamous flock creatures, all they actually want is another bird. They're not bothered about where they are. They just need, they like the humans. They like, they have the same social instincts as a human. They just need something else to relate to. And so they try their hardest for a couple of years and then usually contact us. And we have a number of reasons. One is usually illness, because parrots do provide an awful amount of dust and that can trigger quite a lot of illnesses off. Another one is noise and destruction and aggression, which parrots display lots of when they get to a certain age, usually through frustration of being on their own. And then of late, I think what's happened of late, COVID has actually gave people an insight into how long their parrot stays in the cage. So if you've been in lockdown for 6 months, like a lot of the world has, you're sat with, I mean, and that this has happened to a lot of people who's usually out at work, so they've actually seen their bird. And if the bird's got to that point where it is noisy and aggressive, then it stays in the cage. And they've also learned that when they go on the internet, the people are telling them the truth and saying they're not really the best pet to be sat in a cage on its own for 25, 30 years. So the realisation has just said, well, let's take him to swear at Steve up at the wildlife park because he thinks it's funny. So that's where they end up.
And you mentioned there about the longevity of these birds. I know that African greys in particular, they really do have a long lifespan. And when someone takes one, or preferably more than one, on as a pet, they really are a lifelong commitment, aren't they?
Oh, certainly. And I think the problem we have is what you'll get when you very first start with a hand-reared bird. Remembering there's a lot of complexities about a hand-reared bird, and none of us really fully understand it. The fact that they've not been socialised by their parents usually creates a confused bird, and that confused bird will be lovely, it'll be very attentive, it'll have all sorts of positives when it first arrives. But once it starts getting to between 2 and 5 and natural instincts start kicking in and natural behaviours start kicking in, such that when the old adage of they've fled to the nest, well, that's what parrots usually do at about 2 to 3 year old. They fled to the nest and go and join another colony to create another flock. So then they start displaying these bad behaviours. And if that's going to be like that for 25, 30 years, not many people genuinely keep them for more than 5 years. And I know it sounds very sad. We don't do any kind of drama about it. We don't make it drama. We know it's just a fact. There's a few older people, the parrot keepers of this world, old ladies, without a doubt, are the best parrot keepers. There's no doubt about that. They have a routine in their life. You do as you're told. You get what you're given. Then parrots will stay good parrots for 30, 40, 50 years. When you're talking our kind of modern-day technology and modern-day youngsters, we're all a little bit too fickle and a little too busy to actually have a parrot that we can give any kind of time to. And before they get to 4 or 5, we can see all the negatives. They don't recite Shakespeare when we want them to. They don't sit quiet when we're watching TV. And if you don't get what they want, they give you a good hefty bite. Well, little old ladies didn't put up with that, as we all know, when we look at as grandmothers, how we was treated. And parrots love that. They need a routine in their life.
Maybe you need to get some of those little old ladies in to wash these parrots' mouths out with soap. That's what my grandmother
I'll tell you a very quick story about that. And this is when we're talking about little old ladies. We do a lot of talks here at the WI. And when the WI turn up on an evening time for their cream scones and cream teas, and we go for a walk round, we have to have a renowned African grey parrot who was probably the most vulgar parrot on the planet. And he made a few headlines a few years ago, and we used to hide him. So when I did these talks, I used to hide him out of the way, so when the little old ladies were walking around, they didn't hit this obscene parrot. And they saw it on TV or on radio and said, listen, don't worry about it. We're not bothered. It didn't affect us if we've heard everything. So I said, OK, no problem. So I left him out on his stand where he used to hang about. And while I was talking to the little old ladies, I said, right, I'll go and get your drinks. And he sat outside. And when I came back not quietly, but I was unannounced. So I was walking up the path behind them. And if you'd heard the blow language coming from the little old ladies trying to get him to swear, then that stopped me even being worried anymore. So it doesn't really affect me now.
I love that, I have to say. Just before we leave you, Steve, talk to me about Chico, your singing parrot.
Chico is more famous than all of us now. So people don't even come and say. I do a lot of Facebook live videos to help people throughout the COVID, and we rescue everything from a parrot to a tiger here. So I do a lot of that kind of hands-on to show people what we're doing here behind the scenes. And over the last 6 months, we built up a wonderful following and had lots of shares and lots of likes, and it's been brilliant. And then this damn parrot turns up, who basically in lockdown, he hadn't seen a lot of people. And when we did open the doors, and it literally was on the first day that we opened the doors, I'd heard this parrot while I'd been working and cleaning and feeding, and I'd heard him, and I thought, oh, it's just another opera singing parrot that we've got. But when we opened the door, this Beyonce double set off singing, and both me, the cameraman and the sound man, like, looked at each other, and I said, well, you couldn't get a better video of what you're doing now. And they said, well, we'll just put it out and we'll just see what happens. And let's put it this way, I've done interviews for India, for Australia, for Brazil. Literally, he's as famous as David Beckham at the moment. He literally is everywhere. And people are it's caused us problems with social distancing. And we've had more arguments with customers because we've had to literally go up and say, I'm not worried about you listening to him singing, but we do need to keep the distance between us. And they've all been very, very good and said, yo, that's okay. But what happens is people will be walking around all lovely in the sunshine it's like a nice big serene gardens. And then this beyond, well, it started Freddie Mercury now. He's now going, day-o, day-o. And so what you do is people then set off running around the path to get in front of him. So all the other parrots are quite annoyed with him because they don't get no attention whatsoever. And Chico's just took over.
Describe what he looks like before we hear him sing.
He's a beautiful green parrot, multiple colours dotted about, but he's predominantly green with a lovely yellow crest on top of his head and a nice cream-coloured beak. And he's obviously, as he's turned into a diva, he wears all sorts of different clothes now, and he's got a big Rolex and all sorts because he's nothing to do with us.
And the song he's singing?
If I Was a Boy by Beyoncé.
Sit back, ladies and gentlemen, and enjoy this wonderful performance by Chico the Parrot. Fantastic stuff. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland, and our researcher, John Bell Riley. Thanks also to Richard Collins and to Niall Hatch and Terry Flanagan. Until next week, goodbye.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.